Fastamai, hello and welcome to this edition of Agenda. I'm Ewan Gorn. The Manx Solidarity Fund has paid out around £170,000 to support hundreds of people and businesses through the pandemic. One of the directors, Peter Washington, explains to me how the charity established itself, how many people it's helped, and its long-term plans. Meanwhile, government is investigating new emergency housing for the homeless. Charity Gry, which helps those needing short-term accommodation, gives a cautious welcome but says there have been many false dawns. A charity set up in response to the COVID-19 pandemic has helped hundreds of people with financial support. The Manx Solidarity Fund was created with the objective of helping those in poverty and who've fallen through the gaps amid the health crisis. It's paid out £170,000 at the latest count and says it has much more to offer. I spoke to one of the directors, Peter Washington, who explains how it all started.
How it all happened is it's quite difficult to explain, and I think it's just a collision of minds of people who wanted to help out, and we come from such a diverse background and different areas, we will probably never associate with each other. So it's a true testament to the fund that these people came together to do something like this, and not knowing anybody before, I think time has proven that it works. And it's a true testament to the people on the island that we can set something up so quickly like this.
Explain to me where you step in then. What is the nature of your support?
The nature of our support is that if people feel that they've fallen through the gaps and they can't get any money off the government and they are really struggling, they are on their knees, we're just saying to people, just apply to us. That's the whole crux of it. The Manx Solidarity Fund's there for people just to apply. So we just want you to go online, put an application in, and then we'll go through our process and our due diligence with it. The government can't look at everything and fix everything. So sometimes we've got to anticipate in life that there are going to be gaps. And I think sometimes we've got to look at it from the other point of view for people. If it is COVID-19 related, they've got to anticipate that it's not their fault. COVID-19 was nobody's fault. So you could have quite easily been going along your life, it was all mapped out in front. You knew where you were doing. You lived your life. You took your loans out. You sorted your rent out. You're bringing your kids up. You're doing all those sorts of things. And then when they sit, if the rug's been pulled underneath you, it's just nobody's fault. Sometimes in life, this does happen to lots of people. Life events can come along and they can trip you up. But I think with COVID-19, it was the amount of people that it could trip up all at once.
Yeah.
And that's the big difference that we've got.
Do you have an idea, figure-wise, of how many people have applied roughly to date?
Oh, we're in hundreds of people that have applied. And surprisingly enough, more than 50% are individuals, because we can give help to individuals, businesses, charities. We've been skirting around certain government initiatives as well to give them support. So we do have a discussion about all these areas of what we can do to help people.
And of those hundreds you mentioned there, half of them roughly individuals, how many people are successful and unsuccessful? Because you do have criteria. It's not all comers will be successful, is it?
The criteria, our statistics, we look at our statistics every month, and we're just under 50% of applicants, we are just slightly under 50% are successful in their applications. Mm. Now, some applications that we get that we have to reject are if it's not COVID-19, and that can be heartbreaking for us, really, because you're seeing real people struggling. But we do have a network of other organisations that we can work with, and so we can't like to point them into the right...
Referring people,
where to go, so we don't like to see people completely struggling, you know. But it has to be COVID-19, and some people have took a financial hit as all the other implications. I mean, it does have large humane costs to us and social costs. But when it comes to financial ones, some of the people that aren't meeting the criteria, we can see that at some point they will be coming to us for support, for financial support, but they're not quite there yet. And that's another thing that we have to stick to our objectives. It's a very difficult process that we do go through. The team have to, we rely on each other and the due diligence that we have to do. So when people haven't quite made the lifestyle changes to adjust to the new income that they've coming in, and that can be renegotiating mortgages, renegotiating rent. Some of the lifestyle choices that they're making at the moment aren't conducive with what's coming in. So once they've made all them arrangements and those adjustments, So when people have not been successful, it doesn't say that sometime down the line they can't apply again and they will be successful. But again, with charities, you've got to stick to your objectives. The Attorney General's looking at this. And so, you know, we are doing due diligence on exactly where the money's going. It's going to be open and it's going to be transparent and people can see exactly where it's going. And the same due diligence has got to be done with the money coming in as well.
Well, we'll look at money going out and money coming in then. How much have you spent in support, well, given out in support then? Do you have a ballpark figure?
The ballpark figure at our last trust meeting was over £170,000 has gone out, which is an amazing amount of money, really. And our working capital at the moment, we're talking about £500,000 is what we've got to give to people.
So there's still a way to go with this then?
Well, when we set the charity up, we said we're going to set the charity up, we're going to raise the money, we're going to dish it out, and then we're going to shut us down. It's not a lifelong thing that we're doing. This is just for COVID-19. So, yeah, we are. We're only going to be here supporting while there is that need for people that we're going to be suffering.
When do you draw the line then? Because, I mean, the impact of COVID could go on for years and years and years.
Well, I don't think anybody, when it started, realised the implications, what COVID-19 was going to be, what the implications and impact on society and on communities it's going to be. So we could be here for years. But there again, you don't know with technology. And you've got to have hope. You've got to have light at the end of the tunnel to think that someday we will either live with this or we will get through this or a vaccine will be out and, you know, science will sort it out for us. You've got to. And that's why we've got that clause that we can also give money to things to alleviate. So if, you know, if something was about that could help in people suffering from COVID-19, we could also adapt to that as well.
So how has demand changed from when you set up and now? I mean, is it consistent? Is there a dip? Or
the beginning of the demand was coming from companies that took a hit, and it's not rocket science to work out. It was the companies that were dealing with tourism because they fell off a cliff edge, and that was sometimes we can't always say the company. Because it's you've got to take the view, if it's not sustainable, we can't throw good money after bad, but we can save the people. So if we couldn't help the company to survive, we could help the people to put food on the table and keep them with a roof over their head and help them out. So that's when we are looking at companies, that's another criteria that we've got to work out. Some companies have just got hit by short-term income loss that we could bridge, and they've gone on to thrive, especially the ones that can adapt. And it is proving that there is a lot of adaptability going on in the tourist sector on the island, and the restaurants, pubs and what have you. They seem to be, you know, we're, touch wood, we're doing very well compared to what's going on across.
So with that initial aspect, you talk about tourism there and their immediate need in that sector. I mean, you talk about individuals, about 50%, you said, had received support. On an individual scale, are individuals still needing your help, or are they? Because the reason I ask is the salary support schemes have finished, the MIRA scheme has finished, the big government headline support schemes. I mean, as a result of that, have you seen people going to you guys for help?
We have seen an increase when each scheme has dropped. We've done an advertising campaign out on Facebook and we've seen an uptake in that. So, yeah, we perceive coming up to Christmas that we're going to see even more people requesting help. And you've got to bear in mind that some people will be living off the savings, will be living off being adaptable, family members that are helping out, taking temporary part-time jobs. But as things start getting, the longer that it goes on, we're going to see people's resilience is not going to be what it was. There's possibly going to be people that have just been putting their head in the sand and thinking, it'll be all right next week, it'll be all right next week. So what we're saying is, if you're in that position, it's not a pride thing that you need to worry about. This is what we were set up for. So if you are in that position where financially you are on the that you do need some support, just put the application in and just run with it.
Well, I wanted to ask you about donations. Are people still donating generously? I know you had that sizable donation of £100,000, I believe. Is that being sustained, or are you concerned about that?
We initially started off, and in lockdown, for a charity to start up and start raising money was a bit of an anomaly, really, because you just wouldn't do anything like that, would you? But the 19 marathons that Chris Varley did, that was absolutely amazing. That really got the island together, to say. And that just proved that even through adversity that, yeah, we were able to raise large, substantial amounts of money for this.
Did you exceed your expectations?
I think on all levels with the Manx Solidarity Fund, we've exceeded, well, all my expectations, that's for sure. I'll ask the rest of the board at the next meeting to see what they say. But
you were there to fill in the gaps, I guess, and for anyone who didn't know what they could get. How's that changed? Are you still positioning yourself in the same way, looking for the same people that were affected 6 months ago as are
it's
now?
It's exactly the same, yeah. It's anybody that some people, through circumstances, weren't allowed to claim some of these things, and they were really suffering. And like I said, there's people that have been hanging on and hanging on, and they're going to be coming to a cliff edge where they're thinking, so it is literally anybody to apply. All our applicants go through the same process. They've got to apply online. Because we're all volunteers, we can't get anybody, pay anybody to come and sit down and do these things. And as we're volunteers, we have to fit it into our other working lives and all the other things that go on in our lives. So we're very limited on time, and it can be quite time-consuming. That's why the application is online. So we were aware that there might be some people who couldn't apply online. But again, we've partnered up with another charity, Quing. They've set aside a small room and some computer equipment. If anybody hasn't got the accessibility to go online and do an application, if they go down to see Quing at the old St. Thomas's School, somebody, if they can go in and use the computer there to do the application, and nobody will ask any questions. Even if they need the support to help put it in and to do it, they've trained some of their mentors there to be able to do this as well. So it's again, it's using other charities that are doing good work to you know, we're networking with them to support them, and they're supporting us a lot with doing things like this. So everybody can have access to this fund.
Purchase of medical equipment, I should say, and test kits. That sort of struck me as an interesting objective. What can you tell me about that?
I think when we set this up at the very beginning, it wasn't too clear what was available, and people were trying to write the objectives as broad as they could. And it was at a point when some of the equipment might not be available because of demand. And the government over here are very good at what they do, and they've got the purchasing power to do that. But if something was outside of their brief or whatever, we just put that in to think, well, you know, if they couldn't get it for whatever reason, we needed it. If it was going to be beneficial to the island, we could support doing that.
And you did.
With the oxygen, yeah, to some degree, it was we acted as a conduit with that, and we put the somebody wanted to give the money, somebody wanted to receive the money to get
join the dots. It
did, yeah. It's and that's the other aspect of what we do is sometimes it's life isn't black and white, and it just comes in, and sometimes it's make a quick telephone, and it's like when that vital piece of equipment needed to be over here, somebody knew somebody that had that helicopter to get over and bring it back. So it's one of them conduits of we've got a network of people. So if there's a problem, what's your problem? Can we help? Mm. It's not always financial, which is what we set out to be, but there is other structures there within our organisation that we could quite easily fill a gap or if something falls through the gap.
Is there a story you can tell me about where you, a particular one where you really helped somebody or one that sticks in the memory?
We've probably got quite a few. I think it's very difficult because people that we do help, because of the nature of it, they don't want to go public. And that's we've got to respect that confidentiality. And we're not doing it to publicise us. We're doing it to help other people. But a couple of times at our board meetings, somebody will have read out a personal message that somebody's got from somebody that said, I've had one where we gave one a donation to, and that had a huge impact on somebody else because they were using that kind of service that was in danger of going. And I got that personal message saying, Manx Solidarity, thank you very much. Those sorts of things coming back make it all worthwhile for us. But there is a lot of good work going on out there. And, we do try to put out some of the nice stories that we get, but it can be difficult trying to get people to do that.
One of the directors of the Manx Solidarity Fund, Peter Washington. You're listening to Agenda on Manx Radio. A charity says up to 30 emergency bed spaces would help the island's homeless transition back to normal accommodation. Government is looking for providers who could build what's called the Manx Housing First Support Service. I spoke to Michael Manning, who's from the homelessness charity GRI.
We were absolutely delighted to hear about the expressions of interest going out. And I think it's really important. It's the sort of projects that GRI have been calling for a long time. So there's both an emergency aspect to those projects and the supported housing aspect. And I think both of those are really crucial and would be of huge benefit to many vulnerable people. So we were really delighted to see what is a first step towards hopefully making that much more of a reality. So we warmly welcome that initiative.
So what sort of difference would it make on what you have to do as a charity?
Well, I think in terms of the work that GRI does at the moment, yeah. I mean, the work that we do probably fits into that emergency level kind of stuff, although we're at a much smaller level than the sort of services that the government are thinking about commissioning. I mean, I think it's what the work that GRI has done over the past decade or so has shown increasingly that there is an unmet need there. For very many vulnerable people. And so this would be a really important step in meeting that need. Mm. And whoever is going to be the provider of those services, GRI would be very keen to encourage and support that.
But GRI wouldn't be able to do it as it stands with the funding you've got at all?
No. I mean, we had a discussion. GRI remains a very tiny charity. You know, our committee, the people who run GRI, are mostly volunteers with busy lives themselves. And so we had a good long look at the expressions of interest and a discussion among the committee. And although we're absolutely delighted and very supportive of the projects, we just thought from a realistic position, GRI simply doesn't have the capacity to be taking on projects of this size.
Well, do you hope to be called in for your advice and expertise?
Absolutely, and we're very open to all of that. And so whether it's other third sector providers or anyone else who wants to use our data and our experience with running something similar, we'd be very supportive and very open-handed with that. We're not precious about the GRI doing the work in a sense. We just want to see good work done, and we want to see the vulnerable people, the homeless people of the Isle of Man, better served than they are at the moment. And we really hope that this is an important step towards doing that.
So 30 spaces, how does that meet the demand out there?
Well, we've never had anywhere near that number of people needing to stay in the night shelter.
So this would this really cater for the demand there?
This really would, yes. I think it would. And I think particularly and in a sense, the supported housing element of things, which I think is 20 spaces that the expressions of interest are looking for the supported housing element, is just as crucial. That's the move on accommodation for people when they're out of crisis level, when they're seeking to regain a bit of stability, but still need quite a bit of support.
And those stages don't exist.
They just don't exist, period, on the island at the moment. And so that's a really new thing and a big gap that we've identified for many, many years and have been calling for. So, and I think what's really important is that this gives a sense of, at long last, a sense of priority, time, attention and resources being given to a group of people who are often very marginalised, who are struggling extremely on the edges of society. And so we really hope that this will make a big, big difference. And we just really hope that they come on board and happen as soon as possible.
So having that middle stage, what does that mean? Does that mean fewer people will go back to the first stage and require emergency accommodation again?
Absolutely. One of our huge frustrations is that we'll see extremely chaotic people come and stay in our night shelter. They've lost their accommodation for a variety of reasons and they've ended up on the streets and they need to stay at our night shelter. We managed to stabilise them a little bit. Hopefully they don't need to stay at the shelter too long. It's only overnight. It's not very comfortable. And then we try and move them on into a permanent accommodation as soon as possible. Now, often that's in the private sector at the moment, which is still a whole mix of quality and appropriateness for very vulnerable adults. And what we see is we just see a huge revolving cycle. They might stabilise for a number of weeks, months, but then something will go wrong because they don't have the support, they don't have the life skills, they don't have the capacity to manage tenancies on their own. And and they'll end up back at the shelter. And the more that cycle continues, the more it gets ingrained, the worse reputation you may get as a tenant, and the harder it becomes to break that cycle. And so what supported accommodation does is it says, we're going to give you that support, we're going to move you into a tenancy of your own, but give you a huge amount of support to make sure you've got those skills to maintain a tenancy. And that helps break that cycle, give a greater amount of stability, and work with people on their more long-term problems. So that's, you know, it's been a long-standing frustration that hasn't been there. And so we think if this happens, this will be a big, big benefit to many people.
Now, I wanted to ask, it might not be your area, but is there going to be interest in doing this? I mean, where will it come from? Because I'm assuming nobody's going to be making loads of money out of doing this at all. It's not about that, is it? So where do you think expressions of interest might come from?
Well, I think there's potentially expressions of interest, I think, from other members of the third sector. You know, there are potentially, I think, a number of charities who may be interested in moving into this area. I mean, I've got very little sense about whether there will be off-island people interested in agencies in coming in as well. I mean, we just really hope that there are some expressions of interest.
Well, that's what I'm getting to.
Forward.
I mean, considering that it's, you know, 30 spaces accommodation, that's not a... It's not something anyone can do without a fair bit of capital.
That's right. You know, there's a lot of resources involved in this, just simply in the assets of the buildings and the physical premises, let alone the massive element of running it and providing that support, which is also costly in terms of staff and expertise. Mm. So these are significant projects, and as they should be. You know, I think the vulnerable people of the Isle of Man need that investment and that attention given to them to better serve them than they are at the moment. And we certainly hope that those resources can be found.
So is the penny finally dropping, do you think, on this issue a bit more than maybe it has? We've got this coming online, potentially landlord controls of a certain nature potentially coming in. Do you think there is good traction now on these issues?
I think so, and I think over the past number of years, and particularly within this Tim world, there's been an increasing willingness to talk openly about poverty and an increasing willingness in the rhetoric, certainly, to do something about it. I mean, I've been around for a wee while with GRI, and there are often
good
projects talked about, absolutely. And so we really hope that these will materialise. But certainly I'm probably more hopeful now than I have been for a while that this is something really positive that the government are doing and giving some time and attention to very vulnerable people. So time will tell whether the projects materialise and how they materialise, in the same way that time will tell with the Landlord Registration Bill, a crucial piece of legislation still making its way through Tynwald. But so far, fantastic, very encouraging. And we really want to see these things happen, and we warmly welcome them.
And I have to ask you finally, as a result, now we're sort of in the fallout period from the island's experience of lockdown and other COVID issues. Has there been any noticeable change in use of GRI's services? Are more people using them as a result? Fewer people? Is there any trend?
I think it's difficult to tell, really, at this point. I mean, I think our night shelter has been busier this year than it was last year, but not massively. So those numbers have gone up a little bit, but not hugely.
You trace any of that to the effects of the pandemic at all, or is that hard to tell as well?
I think certainly there's some of that is due to the pandemic. It became very difficult not only to provide that accommodation to people, but very difficult to move people into new accommodation when there are so many restrictions in place. And so people who were ending up in the shelter were ending up in our shelter for longer because it was more difficult to find them alternative accommodation during the stricter part of the lockdown. So that will have an element of play in terms of the numbers in the night shelter. I think one of the things that's also been noticeable has been over the summer particularly, just an increasing sense of a wider, both confusion and anxiety, I think, around coronavirus and the restrictions and confusion around all of that and a sense of underlying anxiety adding into people's lives. I mean, again, many of our guests are already struggling with many chronic mental and physical health problems. So this just becomes an added layer of anxiety and fear on top of all of that. And so it becomes ever more important that they have places of peace and stability, such as the drop-in, such as the shelter that they can come into, knowing that there's a warm welcome, knowing that there's people that listen to them, knowing that there's a safe place to go and where they can get help and advice.
Michael Manning from the homelessness charity GRI. That's all from this programme. We'll be back with more from Agenda soon, and you can listen again to this edition on the Manx Radio website or through Spotify. But for now, gurumayu and goodbye.